Hi, everybody. Welcome to 24 Hours Don't Make an Ideology. This is a special bonus episode. It's our first bonus episode overall, and also our first bonus episode in an ongoing series, Reckless and Me, in which we will be covering the non-24 career of Kiefer Sutherland, which is a multimedia extravaganza. This will include music, lyrics, other films, cooking videos, in general, just everything Kiefer. So we will periodically dip out of 24 world. We'll have several different, I think, like ongoing kind of side projects like this, both to give us a break from the show and also hopefully to kind of shed some light on the show itself. So I'm Ian, as you know, and I'm joined as always by
Ryan Swen. Hello.
Ryan, it's time.
Yes, it's time. We didn't originally intend to sort of break off right at the midpoint of season one, but the timing happened to work out, and we felt that this deserved. We have a lot of different series planned for our bonus episodes, series which have, unlike the show, no limits at all. I think we were actually thinking of doing our sort of 24 core series before, but the, like, as I said, the timing works out. And so we are going to take a walk down Bloor Street.
Can I read you a review here that I think will be helpful to situate us? It's very brief. This comes from Boris E. of Harrisburg, Virginia. The Rodeo Drive of Toronto, Bloor Street. One of the best places for high-end shopping is Bloor Street. Major stores such as Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Company, Hermes, Cartier, and Prada, to name a few, you will find in this street. Excellent customer service. Great shopping and hotels nearby. This is the place to be if you want to experience top-notch service. It is an open area, so be mindful of the weather conditions that you might have to deal with during the winter. This is a review written February 23rd, 2020 on TripAdvisor for the Bloor Street West Annex in Toronto, Canada.
Life was like that all the time before the corona hit.
It's just such a beautiful encapsulation of that moment. Like, I originally was just going to read it as kind of a joke about Bloor Street, but then when I realized that it was like right before we just like lost this, when things became uneven, I guess you could say, in a new way. But I thought it would sort of set the scene for walking down Bloor Street with Kiefer, because if you were like imagining a sort of Bloor Street is a hometown song by a hometown boy, but it's also sort of like wistfully writing a song about, you know, like Fifth Avenue. Mm-hmm. As a New Yorker. And I did not picture that when I first heard the song. So that was an exciting revelation. If you listen to the song, you can imagine Kiefer walking past Louis Vuitton and Prada.
Yeah, it's like we will be covering all the tracks one by one, starting with Bloor Street. But I do have to note first that I have not listened to Vegetable Cutters. I have not listened to any albums by D'Angelo. I haven't listened to like most of Bjork's albums. I haven't listened to any of Big Thief's albums, but I've listened to Bloor Street twice now. This is what the show is going to do to us. I think that's both insane and glorious. So I have to mention that up top. But yeah, Bloor Street, I mean, first off, I think still probably the best song on the album.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah.
Yeah, the best song on the album. And it's weird because, like, for, you know, obviously naming albums can be, it's often, often maybe not so much anymore, but like often name off based off like the lead single or like sometimes the first track. And like the rest of Bloor Street, the album, is like very nondescript or non-specific, whereas Bloor Street, the song, like, as you say, like, it has a sort of like much more wistful tone, much more sort of, you know, nostalgic thing than or like almost like provincial, I guess you could say, instead of the sort of, you know, hyper commerce that's being mentioned. But yeah, like it's just this interesting, you know, like I definitely didn't picture that either. And you know, the music video also doesn't really capture that either, because it's just him sitting in a dark room with a microphone, and also that sort of home footage as well.
Yeah, I actually like the home footage, because I think it makes I think it makes a connection that's not explicit in the song necessarily. Like it's sort of subtext, mm-hmm. and it kind of brings it out. Yeah. Plus, it's just kind of fun to, you know, you see like Donald Sutherland and stuff, and that's kind of an interesting thing. My Apple Music recommendations are going to be so screwed. Yeah. All I've listened to, really, I mean, really, all I think I've listened to in the last month, because I've just been super busy, is like the Beatles rooftop concert.
Yeah.
The discography of PJ Harvey in Bloor Street. And because I periodically kind of work through a discography of an artist that I just want to know more about and feel like I need to like give them that due diligence. But the downside of that is oftentimes, like, you know, I listen through it straight through, so I'm not listening to a singular album over and over. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think I've probably listened to Bloor Street more than any other album this year, except maybe Let England Shake.
Uh-huh.
Which is like the PJ Harvey album that really is like I have a close relationship to and that I've listened to a lot. So yeah, I'm gonna all of a sudden get all of these just really bizarre recommendations.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, PJ Harvey, another artist that I've not listened to, or as I've listened to Bloor Street twice. I was thinking actually about listening to the other to Kiefer's first two albums, Down in a Hole and Reckless and Me, but you know, I think that we'll definitely get to those in due time. And it's just sort of funny, just sort of happening upon this,
yeah.
upon his sort of efforts. In terms of Bloor Street, the song, I do really like how the chorus is like the city of Toronto talking to him.
It reminds me of that Kanye song with Chris Martin from Coldplay. That's what this is. This is Kiefer's version of that. It's called Homecoming, right? Yeah.
What is that from? Graduation.
It's on Graduation, yeah.
Yeah.
I
think I've only listened to Graduation once.
Yeah.
And I haven't listened to Donda yet.
This is great. I didn't realize I was doing this to you by making funny tweets about Bloor Street.
I don't think we had planned it out quite to feature Bloor Street in such a manner.
Yeah.
I mean, when you first tweeted out the video, or like the music video for Bloor Street, I didn't realize that he had an album coming out, but I did know that he had the country music thing. But,
yeah.
You know, when we were thinking about this series, we were thinking more about Fire Walk With Me or even A Few Good Men, and our opening one is Bloor Street.
Well, I think this demonstrates kind of the guiding principle for what we're doing, which is like, mm-hmm. you know, there was a synchronicity of the 20th anniversary that really finally like, convinced me to like actually do this.
Yeah, and me as well.
Yeah, because it just felt like if not now then never.
Right.
And yeah, Bloor Street coming along kind of right in the middle of the first season, I think, when maybe we needed to shake it up a little bit. I like that this is like how we're starting out. It gives us a moment just to kind of goof around instead of having to like analyze the show. Is there anything like I like the, you know, you mentioned the chorus, which I think is sort of a demonstration of the kind of thing that Kiefer is doing, you know, like the verses of this song actually are like, you know, pretty good. Like there's some specificity mm-hmm. here. There's like, I mean, I really do feel like, you know, I want to not just like rag on this, because it's not the kind of thing I would normally rush out and listen to.
I rarely listen to music, new music, as it is.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently I'm exposing, this is like, these are high levels of radiation. I'm worried that yeah. we've maybe done something to permanently poison you.
I mean, I know I do love new music when I listen to it. I mean, you know, I've listened to the Floating Points, Pharoah Sanders, Promises for like 5-6 times.
Oh, that shit's so good. Yeah.
Yeah. That is a great album. We'll be talking a lot about Bloor Street, but I think we can say up top that this is not a conventionally good album, but it gave us a good deal of of amusement.
And, yeah. And you know what? I'll put my chips down here at the start. I actually like Bloor Street, the song.
I've come
to like really have a good relationship with it. Mm-hmm. Like when I, you know, 10 years from now, when I think back on 2022, like if I was going to make a playlist to remember this year, like Bloor Street would be on it. No other song from the record would be on it, but, but I would like in isolation, I think Bloor Street is like a good, it's like the best version of what this can be. And it kicks off the album and, yeah, I mean, it's heartfelt. It's got some, yeah, like some nice little lines. The kind of like personification in the chorus is interesting, even if the lyrics themselves are not really. But, you know, like the streetcars, the relationship to the city. I like that it's a song, you know, set in winter. Yeah, I like the little guitar line that opens it up. Yeah, like it's a nice little, this will be the first of at least two Bob Dylan references, but very vaguely the guitar line reminds me of a guitar line in Caribbean Wind, which is this Bob Dylan sort of B-side from the 80s. It's a little bit like that. There's another song on here that really sounds even more like a Bob Dylan song, but this one has a little bit of,
I agree, but I think we might have a different idea of which one we're thinking about. There's a song that reminds me of Bob Dylan, but I think it's not meant to.
Okay. Even better.
But yeah. But yeah, it's a genuine, like I've come to really like it. I mean, you know, like it in terms of, a modicum of appreciation for it. It gets at the sort of like longing that I think the album at its infrequent best can get to.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's just like largely just because of the personal factor, but still it's got a good feeling to it.
Yeah, it's also one of the places where the polish works.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll rant about this later, but
yes.
One of the problems with this album is that there's so much professional gloss on it.
Yeah.
And I just have to think that if you're in a studio with Kiefer Sutherland, there's not a lot of people saying no in there. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe it's different. But I feel like, you know, an album like this, big producer but smaller label, there's not a lot of there's probably not a lot of push and pull. Maybe, though.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, if there was, though, it doesn't really show up on the record, which is a shame.
Yeah, I agree. Moving on to the second song, Going Down. This one, it's a real come down. Like it's the most, you know, there's plenty of generic stuff on this album, but I think this is maybe the most generic song. Maybe because it comes right after Bloor Street, but like it's so conventional.
I have nothing to say about it. everything you need to know about the song is in the title. Like, you already know the song. You've only heard the title of the song, and you already know what kind of song it is. Avalanche, landslides, you know, broken hearts.
The opening of the second verse is, point your finger, tell your lies as love dies on the vine.
Hang your head and start to cry, because now you realize. There's a certain slavish devotion to the rhyme and meter here. And mm-hmm. I think that really, really leads to these kind of cliches and commonplaces. And, you know, it's not really melodically or musically very, very interesting. Like, there's other stuff going on. It's sort of in this weird, like, Bloor Street hits that great kind of cross-section between this kind of rock and, like, a little bit of country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is just, like, an adult contemporary pop song.
Yeah, exactly.
It feels like something that could have been on the radio by any artist in, like, 2002. Mm-hmm. It feels, actually, no, even more specifically, it feels like the fourth runner-up on American Idol's first single. I don't believe that Kiefer Sutherland wrote this song, because the guy that made Bloor Street, there's no way. I mean, maybe. It just feels, I don't know. I don't want to hate on it anymore.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Yes. Agreed. Next song, Two Stepping in Time, which I might mainly associate with the surprisingly explicit music video that you did.
Yeah, it's pretty saucy.
Yeah, she's like in a strip joint. It's just like, you know, there's a like sort of weird delivery, like just like the sort of the meter is like of the lyrics specifically is sort of like really delivered. You know, it's not bad, it's just like it's odd.
Yeah, you have this sort of like guitar rhythm, which is like the third guitar rhythm you learn when someone teaches you guitar. And then you have like the verse. I will say, like, okay, Two Steppin' in Time is not a very good song, but yeah, it is distinctive in a way that Going Down is not. And it is actually like making this leap between verse and chorus that is kind of surprising the first time you hear it. Mm-hmm. Like this like rhythmic metrical thing that you're talking about. Yeah, it's like, it kind of like goes into this different register. It's interesting. It's dynamic in a way. I actually, for the first time on the pod,
I noticed that. I'm going to have to pour myself. What are you drinking? Bourbon, rye?
I am drinking, it's the bourbon from like, it's like High Country bourbon or something. Okay. The bottle's out of you, or, I think it's made in like Utah or something like that.
I'll be right back. We must for,
I did it for this song.
Yes. For the outro, empty glasses of whiskey show the passage of time.
Exactly.
I'll be right back.
Okay. It is High West whiskey. American Prairie bourbon.
Yeah, just have a Maker's Mark bourbon.
Yeah. It was this song in particular. I'm not an afternoon bourbon kind of person, but I felt like if any occasion demanded it, this one did.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, it's not good strictly speaking, but like it's sort of funny that it's one of the singles. I think that like the song, like, you know, there's many songs that amuse me, but this is one of the ones that amuses me the most.
Yeah.
It's just mainly because of the video. I didn't watch the entire video, but it's just odd.
It's so odd, weird
seeing him like strumming with his like, I think his tattoos are more visible than usual.
Yeah, and it's sort of weird too because the song actually paints this kind of domestic scene, right?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we get this video that's just like totally mismatches.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, they're dancing around the kitchen island.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, I sort of get like, I think this, as far as like a single goes, and I have no idea how much any of this stuff matters anymore, but like, you know, Bloor Street title track, also just like, I think kind of a sort of thesis statement for the album. And I think like a good display of what the album does well, right? Makes total sense as the lead single. This song, I think, is sort of doing double duty as like a more upbeat song, but also a love song. Because there are a couple other love songs on here that are a little more downbeat, at least one in particular that I'm thinking of that is like, not a ballad, but more, more kind of low key than this one. But I think there was maybe a need to get something a little more upbeat out as well. And yeah, I mean, I guess this does it. I will say, you know, like the ashtrays, the empty glasses of whiskey, you know, that stuff is evocative in a certain way. And like, again, I think this is like, you know, we're not dealing with one of the great songwriters of all time. And I don't think Kiefer Sutherland has any pretensions to be that.
Oh, no.
You know, but this feels like, yeah, the guy that wrote Bloor Street wrote this. This doesn't feel as just sort of like vague and kind of generic in the way that Going Down does. So, yeah, you know, this isn't so bad.
A song that's considerably more upbeat, though, is the next song, Soul Full of Love.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, not to make two undue comparisons, but like this is like his Taylor Swift song on the album.
Okay. So I could be wrong. I've read a lot of recent press with Kiefer, so more than a person should. So my wires might be a little crossed. Mm-hmm. But this song is actually about his mom.
Yeah. I mean, like in the chorus, it's just, you know, just thrown in there, like just like he just mentions his mama, turns him right around.
Yeah, not in a sexy way though.
Yeah, but it's just like, you know,
just in a mom way.
This song is the funniest song on that album for me. It's just like, it's so weirdly like country poppy, in a way distinct from like the more like adult contemporary. Like this one feels like he should be singing, like he should be like younger than he was when he started 24 singing it.
I agree. Well, you know, because the thing is, if I didn't know for sure that like he had articulated that this was about his mom, which, you know, is kind of sweet in that way. His mom passed, as another song references, and so, you know, there is something maybe wistful and melancholy behind this. But if I didn't know that, I mean, yeah, I would just assume it was, it's almost like a kind of like puppy love song if you don't have that context. Because it's just like, again, you have this problem of like sort of a generic product of like rhyme and meter struggling to like meet the demands of like what he's set up here.
And he has like especially like interesting intonation when he says like rescue this old hard and just in time.
Overemphasizes
it. Like that's the only time he mentions his age.
It's like, you know, it's about his mom. It's nice.
it's just funny hearing him say I'm so full of love I can't hold it down, floating like a butterfly off the ground.
That's my favorite line.
And he sings it like, because there's a chorus, he sings it like eight times.
He sings it a lot. One time, though, he switches it to floating like a balloon off the ground, leading to, again, this sort of odd phrasing. This definitely feels like a song that had way too much autotune laced over it.
That's sort of like the thing, like where it's very poppy. It's just like it's very produced. Yeah. In a way, I think that, you know, it's not. Well, just because the song is so different. Well, one of the main things about Blur Street is that it's extremely, like, you know, like in terms of like the texture.
Yeah.
Aside from the production stuff, it's extremely inconsistent, I think.
Yeah.
Or it's like going for all these different genres and throwing everything in there. But I think like because of the sort of genre gesturing he's trying to go for, like it works better here. Like that sort of overproducedness. It doesn't make for a good song, but it makes for like a more interesting or like strangely incongruous song.
I thought about also listening to his previous records, but I ultimately chose not to because I just kind of wanted to receive this as is. But yes. You know, my impression from reading about his music career is that the other records are a lot more country inflected. And I think, you know, actually I think he's had quite a bit of chart success in the UK on the country charts there. That's sort of like he had a big European tour and stuff planned. And so I don't know what exactly it is that kind of clicks with the Brits and this music. But I'm willing to say that probably the previous albums are a little more country influenced, and that that might ultimately be for the better. Because, yeah, a song like this, it's almost like just go for it all the way, you know, just like make it a country song.
Yeah,
because you could probably almost kind of sell some of this more ridiculous stuff if you just went like whole hog. But, because it's going for this, like, no man's land of, like, pop, country, rock, like, it just, like, stylistically, you know, isn't able to kind of carry off some of this other stuff. Right. Though, you know, it is fun to listen to in a way. Again, some of the other songs are not.
Yeah. At least in the States, I think that, I feel like we probably account for at least 2% of the total streams of Blur Street.
Yeah, you know, I feel like the struggle with someone like Kiefer in the States is like, you can go to, well, you used to be able to go to, you know, any bar in a mid-sized American city on a Friday or Saturday night and probably, you know, find a band that sounds sort of like this and is kind of doing this type of thing.
Yeah.
They wouldn't necessarily be really good at it, but but in the UK, there's like a novelty to it, you know? Like, I think if you were traveling around here doing like, you know, traditional Irish music or whatever, you'd find a pretty eager audience because there's novelty to it. Whereas, you know, if you're in Dublin, it's like you have to be really good at that because everybody is doing that.
Yeah. Not specifically to this song, but like when I was listening to it, like I was sort of thinking about like, you know, like there's a sort of like, I do wonder if Kiefer saw A Star Is Born and like sort of thought about Jackson Maine and then like sort of
Wow. I want them to remake Star Is Born with Kiefer. Honestly, that would have been awesome.
Yes. I love the film. I love Bradley Cooper in it, but there's an interesting thing to be made of Kiefer.
Just... Yeah. I think I'm going to go as far as to say that that actually might have been a more interesting choice of casting.
Yeah, I think so.
Bradley Cooper's great in it, but yeah, that's, I'm going to be thinking about that.
Yeah, same.
For a little bit. This is probably a good chance to say, and I will also shout out this person on Twitter at some point, but I haven't had the time. We do have a great loyal commenter on our SoundCloud.
Yes.
They have, let me get their username here, Strange Country. You're leaving great comments. Please keep it up. I particularly like the one about Orson Welles. I will at some point soon screenshot that and tweet about it because it's great. But yeah, this is the kind of thing. This is the kind of thing that Strange Country would come up with. So I hope they appreciate this portion of the episode, imagining Kiefer Sutherland in A Star Is Born.
Definitely.
Yeah. So yeah, next is County Jail Gate. What do you think about this song, Ryan?
I actually think this is the second best song on the album.
Undoubtedly.
This is his, you know, like you were talking about Bar Springsteen, but like this is the Bar Springsteen song on the album. Like, you know, it's piano driven, it's like this very much like he talks about stealing a car. There's the more sort of like regular like country stuff where he's talking about kids, you should listen up here, and about how his mom died before like while he was still inside, you know. It's just like it gets it. Like, this is the song that gets it.
I mean, yeah, it sort of starts out with a Thunder Road piano thing, and then line is two tons of steel grinding on the wheels. And then even when you get to the chorus, you kind of get that classic sort of like E Street Band where you get a little bit of percussion and the big guitars come in and you kind of build up. I mean, this is the most, I think more than any other song, this is the one where he's really just kind of wearing his influences on his sleeve. But I will say again, like, I think that this song, you know, the verse you mentioned aside, which is just unforgivable. aside from that, like, if I heard, you know, a sort of raw performance of this in a bar, I'd be like, that was pretty cool. Like, it's, again, it's like a storytelling song. It's, you know, it's got some nice moments, but yeah, under the product, like the slickness of the production and some of these other things, like, it just sometimes works against it. I think in particular on this song with the vocals. Where what you need is like a really raw, like you're doing like the Springsteen thing, like just like lean into it and kind of do like a Springsteen impression, you know, for it.
Yeah. Like the sort of like wall of sound thing that Springsteen was sort of going for, like it still had like all these like the elements, each of them like still felt like clear, or like they felt impactful in a certain way that this can't quite get to. But yeah, it's like, you know, it's, I think it's certainly like one of the most memorable songs, like memorable in like a, you know, more qualitative way rather than like an amusement way of So Full of Love.
This is like, I definitely agree with you, second best song for sure.
Yeah. And remember, if you can't do the time, then don't do the crime.
That's a lesson that I learned real hard.
Yeah.
Just 12 years old when they first took me away because I done stole me a car. You know, that's the thing. Like, I honestly, like, forgot that in this song, it's like, I have no idea if that's actually, like, fact or fiction. I don't think that one is. I think in interviews he said this is definitely about like getting his DUI and stuff. And,
oh yeah,
and
definitely.
He's spent a while in jail in California, but yeah,
as a car stealing type though.
Maybe like as a teenager, 12 years old. I mean, that definitely seems like.
I guess it depends where he was living at the time, also.
Oh, like, that's true.
If he was hanging out with, or like if he was just like, you know, near the MASH guys or whatever. That could influence things in a number of different ways, but
yeah, you know, he's been all over the place. His mom had to flee the country after buying bombs for the Black Panthers because she was cool as hell. The less said about verse three, the better. It's like it starts off kind of like, okay, there's like a lesson here. You know, you were inside and you missed this really important event, which is the passing of his mother. But then it just really like moralizes it and preaches, and it's very bad. And it also just feels like, again, it feels like we're losing Kiefer here, and he's giving himself over to like the certain idea of like what a song like this should do, and he's doing so literally that it just doesn't work. But like the chorus is pretty good. Some of the stuff going on in the verses is interesting.
Yeah,
It's not bad. And again, like the instrumentation, like the studio players they've got on this know what they're doing.
When you hear it, Mister, like that's pure country. That's like the good version instead of like the sort of version that doesn't fit with him. The next song, Goodbye, is another one of the most hilarious songs on the album.
Okay, I do want to say before we dig into it too much that actually the fact that this has the best moment on the record might edge it out over County Jailgate, even though the song that surrounds that moment is an example of like the thing I hate the most in rock music.
And what would that be?
Just like hack blues.
Yeah, that's true. Though I'll also say this is the song I was thinking about, like what, like he's sort of like almost trying to do like a late Bob Dylan voice on it.
No, this is Beyond Here Lies Nothing.
Yes.
It's and I listened to it to make sure this is the song I was thinking of as well. I listened to after I was listening to Blur Street again today, because when I first listened to it, I was like, this reminds me of something. What is it? And I knew it was a Dylan song because I couldn't think. And then I just all of a sudden I was listening to it today, walking home, and I just all of a sudden the lyrics to Beyond Here Lies Nothing went in my head. And it's like the same. I don't know that it's, you know, in the same key or whatever, because I didn't like listen to them side by side, but it's the same. It's the same kind of blues thing that's going on. The chorus in Kiefer's version is more extended because Bob has more like a refrain thing going on. But like this makes a like this is a perfect case study in what separates mediocre rock music from like something as legendary as Bob Dylan. I mean, Beyond Here Lies Nothing is on like it's a good Dylan record, but it's late Dylan, and like of the great late Dylan records, it's probably the one that is like toward the bottom, even though it's very good. And yeah, the
Together Through Life.
Yes, Together Through
Life, which I haven't actually listened to.
Yeah, it's a good album. It's got a lot of good songs on it. I mean, I really like it. It was like the first new Dylan record that came out after I got into Dylan, so it holds a special place. But you know, it's not like in my top 10 or anything.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But Dylan takes this sort of like very, very hackneyed, or like to put it maybe more generously, this very old traditional kind of like blues figure, and he's got like the best band in the world just blazing through it, and then he laces over top of it just like this, his voice sounds like, you know, gravel. And his lyrics of course are fantastic, you know, and it's like this juxtaposition of something that so easily becomes cliche and hacky, and it just like works like gangbusters on that album. It's maybe my favorite song off the record, but here in slightly less capable hands, and it even starts, I the first line of the Dylan song is I love you pretty baby, and the first line of this is don't you know that I've always loved you. It's like this thing. Kiefer definitely just took the chords from Beyond Here Lies Nothing, but you know what, that's proof that Kiefer's a late Bob head, so he and I would get along. It's fun.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, like, you know, I would not be surprised if Kiefer has, you know, if not like the best taste in the world, like good taste. Like he listens to, you know, a good range of stuff, including like Dylan. But yeah, like the beginning of verse two is I can see the tears welling up in your eyes, something I've seen way too many times.
Then the next couplet's great too. Been under your thumb so long, it's made me mad. But there's nothing you can do to make me feel sad.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk about the moment of the song we both absolutely love, though?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's not unheard of to see Kiefer swear, and there's actually a moment in the, I think it's season six, like the sort of intro, or like the sort of like before, like, you know, a few hours before or something like that, like where he does actually say fuck, but like it's still funny here, like where he says in the last chorus he says, so don't even try, I'll see you in hell when I fucking die. which produces the sole explicit tag on the album.
Well, and he also does it in, like, he's got this real deep, almost like Johnny Cash-esque. Mm-hmm. Like, in it, and I think it's, like, it's partially deployed for humor.
Yes.
But also, like, it's a great vocal moment because it actually sounds like Kiefer, like, having fun and also sounding like himself and not, like, there's this great line, David Berman, Silver Jews. Mm-hmm. All my favorite singers couldn't sing. And I think, like, you know, there's this thing about at least, like, the singing that I really like and I'm impressed by, which is that, you know, on the one hand, yeah, you know, it's technically proficient, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But, like, it's actually the so-called flaws in a singer that make them interesting and distinctive, right? Like purely, like only technical proficiency is actually not very interesting.
Yeah.
And in that way, I think it's very much like acting. And this is a moment where Kiefer sort of understands innately that singing and acting share like a kinship. And like he's doing that here. And it's this great line that just kind of like comes out of this song that you're not really expecting a lot from. And yeah, it's a great, it's the best moment on the whole album. It's it's awesome. It sounds great.
Yeah, of course that extends to like to instruments to some example, like, you know, Miles Davis, like not the most technically proficient, like, but quite possibly the greatest because he had this sort of feeling about it. It's a good moment because it comes out of nowhere, and it comes after like the first and not the only use of like a evident like background chord, background singer. I couldn't tell if it was a male or female singer, but like it's just like this sort of weird. It's just weird after having like so much after having his vocals pretty much as the only vocal element, just having a singer just come in right then.
Yeah, and it also kind of heightens the contrast. It's almost like bringing the background singer and lets Kiefer feel like he can kind of loosen up a little bit on the vocals. And like, yeah, I mean, man, I'd love to just tell Kiefer, like, dude, make your Nebraska. You know, like, just let your voice sound the way it sounds, because it's gotta be like, and you can see a little bit from some of the videos he's posted and stuff of him just kind of playing that. He does sometimes have this like try hard thing he does where he's really trying to hit the note. But then there's other times where he just kind of, he lets himself be a little like off key or a little flat, or just kind of express the lyrics in a way that isn't so bound by like tight metrical production. And I wish I could just shake him and be like, Kiefer, make an album like that. It'll like genuinely, it would probably be really good. For what it is, you know, just like making it sound like you and not like all this other stuff, because like there's no reason. Like, I understand sort of why certain artists get like produced to hell, right? But like, you're Kiefer Sutherland. Like, as long as you have money, you can make albums. And you know this. Like, again, I think he's fairly humble about this whole thing. I wish he would just be like, yeah, I'm just going to kind of like get someone to produce who is going to kind of push me to be more like me than like to make this kind of polished, glossy stuff.
I do think his voice is always higher than I expect it, though.
Yeah.
Like, I just always think of him as like more, you know, if not totally like bass or anything like that, like something a bit like deeper than he actually is. So like that always takes me by surprise.
I think he could bring all these songs down like a step.
Yeah, probably could.
And it would be better just instantly.
Because
he's got kind of a nasally thing on the higher notes that that isn't working.
I think the next song, Lean Into Me, sort of gets like definitely exemplifies that.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, well, I first heard this in the sort of, you know, that Fireside Farkin freezing. It is actually getting pretty chilly here in LA, unfortunately. So, but yeah, so I was thinking about that. But yeah, it's a, I don't know, like it's sort of him trying to go for an anthemic thing, but it's not really coming, like it's not quite really working.
Yeah, he draws out the word lean, which is already like a nasally word. And when he's hitting that, like that higher register, he's especially prone to sing through the nose more. And yeah, it's just not good. It's a boring song.
Yeah.
It's not, it's not quite as generic as Going Down, but it's pretty close.
It's, yeah. Yeah, you can just lean into me and I'll be your firewall.
You know, what?
No, I don't hate it. It's just funny. It's just funny hearing him say firewall.
It's very 24.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I sort of like, I almost kind of like that because it is sort of like a goofy metaphor. But even funnier is lean into me and I'll be your cannonball.
he was running out of words that ended with all.
Yeah, he just ran out of rhymes.
That does make me wonder about his writing process. Like if he spends tons of time just like thinking, slaving away. If it's like the beginning of Ishtar.
Yeah. You know, okay. I actually did have an idea about the cannonball line, which is that, you know, Dink's song. Sort of famously featured in Inside Llewyn Davis for all the film buffs out there. But very old sort of bluesy folk song. Does have this line about, you know, moves their body like a cannonball. So it does have kind of like a lineage and tradition. So I can sort of see how he got there a little bit. but in the context of the song, it still makes no sense at all. That's all I have to say about that song. Next we've got Chasing the Rain.
The longest song on the album. None of the songs on the album like past 4 minutes. This is pretty compact. It runs less than 38 minutes. Still, like this one, I think maybe just because like the accumulation. Like the weird thing about this album is that it seems to both like be longer than it is, and also feels like it ends before it can really get going. And this song, I feel like it's like the moment where it like starts to. Like the back half, back quarter, or back third of this kind of drags.
Yeah, yeah, it does.
Or like it's more generic, or like more you know, like just more like, you know, samey. Like he ran out of the sort of, you know, the bizarro sequencing of like So Full of Love and to kind of Jill Gate to Goodbye. Like those are all distinct, you know, for better or for worse. But like these four are all pretty much the same.
Yeah, I mean, Lean Into Me, Chasing the Rain, Nothing Left to Say. I will have more to say about Set Me Free, but and Down the Line in particular. I mean, 4 out of 5 of the last 5 tracks are basically the same song.
Yeah.
Just like kind of different variations. This goes back to the Springsteen well, but more the kind of big E Street sound. Yeah, it's kind of like something I noticed, or, you know, just looking at the lyrics on Genius. You know, it's got, the lines are a little bit longer. There's, you know, a couple of, like, there's a verse kind of about, like, out playing shows and,
I think this, you know, is when I started, maybe because they mentioned Portland, Maine, that's maybe what made me start thinking of Star Is Born.
yeah, maybe that's why I put. Yeah. Maybe we should recut a scene from Star Is Born to this. I wish I had that ability. That'd be good.
I could try.
We could probably get 5 to 7 likes on the Twitter account for that one.
Provided we don't get a copyright strike.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love that though. We could like frame that, hang it in the pod office. Yeah, you know, chasing the rain, staking our claim, singing our songs again and again, like a band on the run. You know, there's a golden rule that I think is really important to follow, which is that if you're going to remind someone else of some other art, it can't be better than what you're doing.
Yeah.
And like, this is not Band on the Run.
Yeah. Keith. We need Kiefer's McCartney 2.
I would love Kiefer's McCartney 2. Yes. I would love Kiefer's Ram, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like he could pull that off. he could go up to his ranch. is he married right now? I don't remember.
I don't remember.
You know, maybe he's by himself. Maybe he's got a lady with him. I don't know. Maybe he brings his family, whatever. Maybe him and Don just go up there and drink whiskey and ride horses.
Apparently he's currently engaged.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. They live in Toluca Lake. Interesting. That is the valley. So he's back there again.
Back where he belongs.
Yeah. Oh, his fiance is a trained saxophonist.
Oh, that's, see, right there. Why isn't she on this album?
Yeah,
like right there would just automatically, like, again, if you're just gonna do like like light beer Springsteen.
Yeah.
Just like bring in a sax player, you know? Like just give it to us. Like I'd be less mad about that if it was just like, hey, I'm Kiefer Sutherland. I really like Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
Like just do that, you know?
Apparently she toured with them on Down the Hole, but she did not play on the actual album.
Okay.
Interesting.
Well, when Kiefer tours again, I'll have to check it out.
Yes.
See
I mean,
what's going on.
Yeah. I hope that he does an LA concert sometime soon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got to keep an eye on that.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like eventually he'll come somewhere in my neck of the woods because, I mean, this is kind of like prime. This is the prime zone for his music.
Yes.
Right here in the middle of the country. But, yeah, he's probably more likely to play an LA show before he plays in Nebraska. So.
Yeah, probably. But, yeah, moving on to the next song, Nothing Left to Say, which
well,
is
what else
apropos. Actually... In Chasing the Rain, there's a lyric that made me very amused where he said, the songs I sing all start to feel the same.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I forgot about that. I struggle because I'm developing a parasocial relationship with Kiefer Sutherland.
Yes.
But I do sort of think there is something a little bit self-aware about him.
Mm-hmm.
Not
mm-hmm.
in like the, you know, not in our kind of like irony poisoned millennial way.
No, yeah.
But definitely in that kind of, I don't know if he's like Gen X or if he's technically a boomer. I feel like he's more Gen X, but I don't know. That stuff doesn't matter. But the point is, I think he has a little bit of perspective about like his place in the world and what he does.
Yeah. Yeah, he's 55, so I think that's more Gen X.
Yeah, that's closer. Yeah, yeah, so he's a little bit he's a little bit younger than my dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean like okay, like this is, you know, this is my dad and I have sort of developed this relationship where there's like a certain type of music we both really like.
Mm-hmm.
And like some of it is like stuff I turned him onto when I was in high school. Right. But he's always been a guy like music, you know, he showed me The Police and U2 and like Talking Heads, like 80s stuff he liked. But I could see like a slightly different version of my dad, like who learned the guitar when he was 18, like, and now like plays in a bar band that sounds like this. Like,
yeah.
That's not that far off. And there's something a little bit endearing about that. And you know, Kiefer, unlike someone like that, has a little more resources and stuff to promote and things like that. But you know, the CD that he's putting out just sort of feels like something to sell at the shows. I think he probably thrives on like the live stage.
Yeah.
And like that, you know, touring life and playing with the band. I feel like he lives more for that than for putting it on wax, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that there's I think the thing that this really shows, and I think that we'll get a lot of in terms of his acting work and just throughout the series, is that he's very earnest. Like, he just seems like an incredibly earnest, like for someone of his celebrity, like he does seem incredibly earnest about like what he does.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, one of the things that I think makes him so interesting. And
yeah.
So, and like the way that his sort of image has been molded and shaped in different media, like especially interesting is, you know, like even though he's been cast so much as like a macho guy and there's obviously elements of that, like he also has this very, like he's trying to, like he, you know, I think only Blur Street and maybe kind of Joe Gate really get to it. But like there's like this sort of like earnestness and this sort of like simplicity that he's really trying to push that his songwriting skills can't quite get to most of the time.
Yeah, there's something he's, I think, like very realistic about where his career is at and what he does, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like there's that Sydney Morning Herald interview that I think I posted a while back. You know, he's like, he seems like a pretty, you know, magnanimous kind of guy.
Yeah.
He talks about like, you know, he's kind of a workaholic, right? And,
right.
You know, the pandemic really made that difficult for him. And then, you know, like he's, and this cuts across a couple of his recent kind of press appearances where, you know, it's sort of like people ask him why he moved from movies to TV, and he's talked about, you know, doing 24, and like, on the one hand, in one of the interviews, he sort of makes a sort of like half-hearted defense and being like, well, you know, TV was doing a lot of interesting things around that time. You had ER, you had The Sopranos, like, it was starting to be perceived as like less of a downgrade for a movie actor.
Definitely.
But then also in this other interview, he's just like, I had a like real job that had like normal hours, or like, you know, relatively semi-normal hours for him for like, you know, almost a decade. And when you're doing movies, you know, he's sort of like, I'm this workaholic. And like when you go like 3 to 6 months without anything, you know, but you have to be ready for the next thing. That's right. incredibly hard. And, you know, this is me reading between the lines, but I'd imagine that, you know, whatever, like, I don't know that he's described himself as an alcoholic, but I know that, you know, he's had several DUIs and he's had issues with that. Yeah. And I'd imagine that, like, you know, consistency makes that much easier to manage. Like when you know what you're doing, when you're doing it, and you have a job to do, and the kind of up and down life of, you know, the movies and like being kind of like at one point kind of a up and coming, you know, maybe like I think star is the right way to put it, you know, certainly a recognizable name and face. Right. Like all of a sudden you have all of this freedom financially along with, you know, these stretches of time where you don't have to do anything except like whatever you want to do, you know? So I like that about him. And I think, you know, to me, if like what he needs to do in his downtime is make some albums, good for him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how long this recorded for, but like, I, you know, I feel like there's a decent amount of time. I feel like he probably, you know, really liked having that, you know, just that sort of consistency of it, just like going in, and probably touring does much the same thing for him. Like it's, hopefully it's like almost therapeutic in a way, just, you know, just going out on the road and doing that. But yeah, nothing left to say. Not much to say.
Yeah, nothing left to say.
Yeah, but I guess moving on to Set Me Free, which is all this is this one is like the other real Springsteen one, simply because it's so much about cars.
I actually immediately thought of Drive My Car by the Beatles. This is a rewrite of Drive My Car, but like, yeah, in Springsteen world.
Yeah, in Springsteen world, like, yeah, like this old car is for sale, you don't have to pay retail.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, it's him. I mean, obviously
make an offer and you'll see it ain't that hard to get into me.
But like, this is not horny like Drive My Car is.
I actually sort of think it is.
I mean,
maybe
a
on
little
accident
bit. I don't think it's like, as you know, Drive My Car is, you know, very much a double entendre.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, I like, you know, you can definitely be read that way, but it just like, just the presentation of it doesn't quite really feel like it. I mean, like, you know, whereas Thunder Road is very erotic in its own way, like strap your arms across my engines, like that is a very horny line.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, like, you know, like I could legitimately see Kiefer like not realizing.
Well, that's sort of how I read it. It's kind of like a little unintentional.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think like on the one hand you have this heartfelt thing of like, you know, this metaphor of like, I'm getting older, I've got some miles, you know, I've ridden this body pretty hard at times. You know, I've got all kinds of hang-ups and quirks and peeves and all of that, you know. I'm not the sort of young up and coming you know, star that I was. But then you kind of like, he takes that metaphor like two steps too far, and then it's like, this got unexpectedly sexual.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm kind of with you on that, is that I don't think that he necessarily thought of it that way.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I sort of think he's the kind of guy who maybe someone pointed out to him and he's like, yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah.
You know,
let that
reading stand, even if it's not maybe what I was going to do.
Yeah. There's I mean, it's also like, this is definitely the best song off the second half.
Oh, for sure. It's the only time that anything gets switched up.
Yeah, I could definitely see him like sort of like maybe like, you know, the next time he sings it after that, like maybe like he leans into it a little bit more, you know, like he's like sort of like goes up and down, but
yeah,
he definitely wouldn't like lean into it fully. Which is like, you know, both good and bad. But like it feels, you know, honest to him is sort of his trajectory, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I hate the title though. Set Me Free. Awful title for such a sort of like distinctive song.
Yeah, I don't know, 300 horses out of this V8. You know, there's some good lines in here, or some like decent, like, you know, sort of not totally generic songs.
It's a car song. Car songs have great names. I don't know why he's just spent a little more time workshopping that. Yeah, that's the kind of thing, again, that in a studio, you know, if you had someone that was maybe a little more oppositional, might be like, all right, Kiefer, I dig this. I dig what you're doing. Like, Set Me Free is not, like, I'm expecting the kind of same sort of, like, ballad, you know, melancholic love song that you've got going on the second half. And so it doesn't set itself apart.
Yeah. Like, looking at the second half of these song titles, it's, like, all the same.
Yeah.
Whereas like, this one is like more, you know, there's actually something more going on. So
Chasing the Rain is the only one that's even like remotely evocative after County Jail Gate. Like everything else is just so, so generic. And then we have the last track, Down the Line.
I think at this point, like it was starting to wear on me. So like, I didn't really notice much about this.
It's a weird
closing track also, because
it doesn't make any sense.
It's just like it's the same as everything else, so it doesn't feel conclusory in any way.
I definitely feel like there needed to be one more track on here that did something very different.
Yeah.
Even if it was just kind of Kiefer on acoustic or something, you know.
Yeah. Oh, acoustic Kiefer would have been very nice. You know, like you gotta go for like the, you know, you gotta go for like the Springsteen Four Corners approach.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas, you know, like, and they're like, there's something, like, real, like, a big heft to like, the last tracks on Darkness at the Edge of Town or Run. Whereas, like, this one is just, there's nothing different about it.
The first time I listened to it, I just had my headphones in, I was walking around. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, the album accidentally paused after this song. It just felt so much, like, not a conclusive end.
Yeah.
Like, I guess you have the background singer again here and some
things, but that's so bizarre. Like the half of the song is sung by a female singer, and you know there's not really any anything else. Like, it's just like that. You know,
I think one of the problems with the kind of production that's being applied here is that it's not. The album could be dynamic, but everything is kind of dialed to the middle.
Yes, definitely.
Like, we're never allowed real, real soft, quiet moments or real, real big moments. Mm-hmm. And so, by 38 minutes, it's all kind of, most of it blends together. The producer, though, Chris Lord-Alge, he's a big deal. I've known about him. He produced Prince's Batman soundtrack. And
Oh, really?
Yeah, he produced, I know he produced some Tina Turner stuff. Mm-hmm. He did Springsteen. Dancing in the Dark.
He did Dancing in the Dark?
Yeah, yeah.
What?
I think he's mostly been doing kind of Nashville country stuff. He was the mixing engineer on American Idiot. I'm kind of just looking at some of the stuff. He's well known enough that like I know his name and I don't know very much about big music producers.
He did a Rocky IV soundtrack.
He mixed James Brown's Gravity. Like some of these he mixed, some of them he produced. He's done a lot of different work. He's been in the industry for a long time. It's, you know, I would hesitate to say this probably isn't the most distinctive work he's done. He's not, it's not his fault. It's not anybody's fault. You know, it is what it is. If you make an album and there's one good song on it, you know, that's an achievement. It's actually writing songs is really hard.
You get the Kreisgau, the scissors.
I think this is probably a Joker Man one star album, but that one star, Kiefer works pretty hard for that one star. It's not a zero star album, an album made by a kind of TV movie actor who has no business making any good songs at all, you know. The fact that he not only makes a good song but definitely tries to make a few others is worthwhile, and he's having a good time with it. I don't begrudge him the ability to do that.
Oh yeah, definitely. We have spent way too much time talking about Blur Street, but
how did we go for an hour? I thought it had been like 30 minutes. Jeez. Yeah.
I was like checking the recording throughout, and I was sort of like bewildered about how long we were going.
Oh wow. Okay. Well, that's gotta be my fault.
We did talk about a good amount of like, you know, background stuff. I think this is good background stuff for our our further looks at Mr. Reckless. So I think, you know, obviously there's a good chance that we'll repeat some of it, especially for those who might understandably not want to listen to an hour of discussion about a forgettable country album. But still, it's a, you know, I think this is, we will persist. I can definitely say that.
Yeah, the only last thing I will add is that I recently found out that Kiefer Sutherland has a Mickey Mouse tattoo where he's holding a machine gun and reading a book called How to Kill, which he says in this Guardian article that he thinks it's, quote, cute and funny. So I think he's got a good sense of humor about the world, about himself. He'll never listen to this, so it doesn't really matter. But, you know, I hope he keeps playing. I think everybody should have music as a part of their life. So I'm glad Kiefer does. And I hope this wasn't, you know, the worst hour of podcasting you've ever heard.
No, it's fun. I mean, I think that's the key thing. He's having fun. We're having fun. Reckless and Me will return at some point, probably pretty soon. But yes, we will be back to our... I think we were just thinking about like maybe, you know, recording just like a quick thing and just dashing off in between our regular scheduled thing. But we decided to make it, it's a good way to introduce our bonus episodes.
Yeah.
And, like, I think we've discussed Patreon stuff. We might do that at some point. And, you know, we'll see about exclusives or anything like that. But for now, they'll be on the main feed, which I think is good for our patron saint.
it was great talking about this with you, and to those of you listening out there, give Blur Street a spin. Particularly, I mean, really, the title track. I can wholeheartedly recommend the title track at this point.
Yes, I agree with that as well.
Throw it on your, you know, kind of winter malaise playlist. It's a nice it's a nice little switch up from what I normally listen to. So we'll be back with more 24 in a couple of weeks.